ranked one of America's top research universities, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries on UWM today. Here's the host, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor of University Relations.
Wisconsin is a state that makes things. Manufacturing is one of our largest industries, employing hundreds of thousands of people. And among them are engineers, the people who design products and the equipment needed to make them. Today, that process often involves looking at ways of remanufacturing products rather than starting from scratch. Our guest on today's program is Wilkie Starr Otieno, a UWM Associate Professor of Industrial and Manufacturing Engineering who believes sustainability has an important place in the factories of America. Welcome, Wilkie Starr. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here today.
Let's talk about this notion of starting from scratch. You don't always have to do that if you're working with companies that have machinery that breaks, that is needed to be upgraded. Your direction and the work that you're doing suggests that sometimes you could work with what you've already got.
That's true. And there's several drivers that make this an importance, particularly for products that are used by companies whose production has already been laid, and they cannot change their production line ever so often so that they can fit the new version of whatever product that's coming in. So that's one of the drivers that's customer facing. The other drivers is the society. The society nowadays is moving towards sustainability as a whole. And so people want to know, hey, if I buy a refrigerator, it's not quite sustainable if I keep it for just 1 year and throw it away. And secondly, where do I throw it away? It's expensive to throw a refrigerator away because you have to pay somebody to dispose of it. And so you ask yourself, where does it go then? You want to know, okay, the metals are just a year old. Where will they go? Can they be recycled? Can they be reused or remanufactured? And so indeed, there are several drivers that are moving us towards that direction.
Yeah, anybody who's made investments in what they call durable products, you know, whether it's a washing machine or a fridge or a car, you know, one of the biggest investments folks have, nothing more frustrating than to see it stop working the way it should and then be told, well, you have to get rid of the whole thing. That is not very price effective, is it?
That's true indeed. As opposed to an electronic, a cell phone, for example, where there are other incentives as to why you should buy a new one, you know, new apps, new speeds. As opposed to that, these other heavy equipments are more expensive. You need them to work for a longer time so that you can get the money's worth out of it.
So yes. A lot of your work is with the companies that are making those products.
Exactly.
Let's talk about the research that you've been doing in this area. And there's a term that I read as I was researching the program that I think is really interesting when it comes to this whole notion of remanufacturing. You call it analytical hierarchical performance modeling.
Yes.
That's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful, but it's not new. A hierarchical analytical process has been used, and in short abbreviation, it's AHP. It's been used a lot in conflict analysis and resolution. It's been used in organizational management studies where you're taking the views of different people and putting them together so that you can come up with one concise, precise decision. And for our case, we use the hierarchical model, put it together with the fuzzy logic model, which again is not new at all. And so what the hierarchical model says, okay, if I take a product, what are the drivers for remanufacturing? The first one is the economic driver. How easy is it to acquire it from the customer? How easy is it to transport it to whoever it is who's remanufacturing it, whether it's the person who made it or a third party? How easy is it to disassemble it? How easy is it to reassemble it? What do I need to replace or remanufacture, so to speak, component-wise, to make it as good as new? The other is the societal part. So all these elements are the lower level of the hierarchy. You solve each of these elements, so the economic element is solved by itself. The social element is solved by itself. The legal element is also solved by itself, because in the EU, there are some tariffs that are placed. If you dispose something that's been used only for whatever number of months or just of, you know, a few years, and then the very
So there's
last
almost
one,
a tax on that.
Yes, there is a tax on it.
It's not just
it.
The cost of replacing
exactly.
it, but you're penalized if you do that.
Exactly. And then the other one that I didn't talk about, which is really the sustainability portion, is really the energy material saving part of it. Okay, so you solve all of these elements single on the lower level, and then on the upper level, you kind of combine them together using some fuzzy logic rules. And so you say, if the economic value is this number here, and if the social value is this number here, and if the legal value is this number here, then the remanufacturability is this level. So that's really the hierarchical process.
And so what you're doing is applying a formula that at the end really brings a much more scientific approach
exactly.
to making these decisions, rather than just a gut feel or eyeballing
yes,
it.
Yes, yes.
When you think about the types of products where this works, are we discussing you know, a refrigerator that, you know, may cost $700 or $800, or are we talking about the piece of equipment that may have cost $7 million but is used to make thousands of refrigerators?
Well, it could be used for across the board. So I had two students who worked with me on this. The first one is Thomas Omwando, who is currently a faculty in the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. And he used this model, applied it to the Rockwell automation control drives. And the drives span the range of values. You can take it from, you know, $100 value to thousands of values.
And these are the parts of a machine that
exactly.
determine how fast they run. And,
exactly. How fast a motor should run. So they call them variable frequency
right.
control drives. And so it can run the, you know, the range. And then the other student was, we called him Leo. He is from Taiwan. So UW-Milwaukee has this exchange program with a university in Taiwan, the CYCU. And so the student came in and, you know, finished up his master's program here. And he actually used this model to compare the remanufacturability of office equipment. Because we looked at literature and we realized that not only are we really remanufacturing equipment that is used in production or even consumer products, but also in the space of, you know, office equipment. There are some companies, particularly two companies, none of which is in Wisconsin, that is really making a profit out of remanufacturing office equipment.
So again, this notion of not needing all new fresh ingredients,
exactly.
all the raw materials
yes.
that
yes.
that go into creating the aluminum piping or the tubing or
yes.
the steel bars, that basic underlying infrastructure can be reused.
Exactly. And the good thing about this model is it uses what we call normalized values, and so it can take numerical input. Think of the value, for example, the cost of remanufacturing. That's a continuous variable. And then it takes what we call categorical inputs. How tedious is it to disassemble it? So you can take that and categorize it into a scale. It can also take linguistic variables, right? Where somebody is saying, hey, as a customer, what is your likelihood of buying a reused cell phone? You cannot put a number to it, but you can put it in a linguistic scale. So the fuzzy logic is really good because it takes all these variable types of input and normalizes them with values that can be comparable. And so it enables you to compare sort of, you know, quote unquote, oranges to mangoes, but in a value that can be comparable.
And does it allow you to factor in the emotion of a customer?
Exactly. Because which is expressed as a language, yes.
Okay, because some customers may say, you know what, I know a new machine might be a little bit faster,
yes,
but I really don't want to rip this one out of the middle of my production cycle.
Exactly.
And that thing is still pretty good. You know,
yes,
there's some people may just have they may be cost conscious themselves, very conservative in terms of where they spend their resources. So there may be an overwhelming sentiment to keep what we got.
Exactly.
And your work is helping them decide whether or not at the end of the day that makes financial sense.
Exactly. But also, I would say the reason as to why we started doing this work is Rockwell Automation is one of the largest free manufacturers in the world.
And a great employer here in Milwaukee.
Great employer in Milwaukee. I think they easily employ more than, 900 of UWM alumni, which is great. And so for them, remanufacturing is not just to enable them have a good relationship with their customer base, but also it's profitable as well. And again, going back to the sustainability, they're able to promote manufacturing sustainability. So the reason as to why we started this is because they receive the used products from the customer. The associate makes a decision as to whether they should remanufacture or not remanufacture it and send a new product out.
Is there a bias in some quarters against remanufacturing or using used equipment? Is that an impediment that you have to overcome where people may say, oh, come on, it's 10 years old, it's 15 mm-hmm. years old, it's time for a new model? Do you ever run into that?
So the impediment could be both ways. It could be an impediment from the customer's view, but I think that's easier to solve from the manufacturer's point of view, because all a customer wishes to have is assurance of the quality, assurance of reliability. And I think as a manufacturer, or a remanufacturer as well, it's upon the company to ensure that that is done. Assurance of quality and reliability and safety as well. And then on the other end, it could be from the customer as well, where a remanufacturer will say, how long can we sustain your product? You know, to a point where at some point, maybe Rockwell might be required to find components on eBay in order to sustain a legacy product. And so in that case, then Rockwell Automation has to have foresight of how they're going to sustain these drives that are legacy, because drives can stay up till 20, 30 years when used in the right environment. And so I think it's a challenge from both ends, both customer and remanufacturer, to work together to kind of surmount these impediments.
How about the profit margin? Does that ever work into this?
Exactly,
remanufacturer
yes.
says, well, you know, we could make X amount on fixing it,
yes,
or we could make twice as much if we build a new product.
And that's the good thing about this model, because it takes that cost perspective as well and says, okay, it might actually sometimes cost more than 100% the value of a new product to remanufacture a product. But remember, we are not just looking at the cost alone. We are also looking at the customer side of it. How much do they need this? And so considering this model, then, you know, the lever will tilt towards remanufacturing it, much as the cost is high. And so, but on the other hand, we are thinking volume-wise. So the company has to have a trade-off between the bulk which they remanufacture that is cost effective versus the one that they remanufacture that they might not be cost effective but are quote-unquote cost effective from the perspective of keeping the customer satisfied.
And at the end of the day, a satisfied customer,
exactly.
The loyalty, you know, the commitment to stay with that brand could, in the long run, mean even more value for for the company making the equipment.
And those are those intangible profits or intangible values of remanufacturing that cannot be put to a figure.
To what degree does the green environment, the popularity in many among many people to have a more green, sustainable environment, how much has that helped people that you work with in the manufacturing business accept this notion that reusing, remanufacturing is a good thing? Has that popular sentiment made this whole notion of remanufacturing more popular?
I think so. Yes, indeed. And, you know, recently the Department of Energy funded something we call the Remade Institute. And it's a coalition of universities, top-notch universities, among which UWM is, and there are university members, there are company members, and the goal of Remade is to foster innovations in sustainable manufacturing. So we live in a world where we can see, for example, we can see how much havoc plastic has done to our oceans and waterways.
Read stories about it every day.
We cannot avoid it. We can't but. So the goal of Remade Institute is really to increase the usage of what they call secondary feedstock and reduce the usage of primary material. And so the challenge now is to make sure that the secondary feedstock has good quality that can rival the primary feedstock.
And that's where an engineer comes
in,
right?
Yes, that's where the engineer and that's where the company relationship comes in. Because we think about it, we think it can be done, but the company is where we can see it working.
Really prove the theories that,
the theory
that look good on
the
paper.
Models, exactly.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujak, and joining us in the studio is Wilkie Starr Otieno. Wilkie Starr is an associate professor of industrial and manufacturing engineering at UWM and one of the experts in sustainable manufacturing. Wilkie Starr, I want to talk a little bit about what brought you to engineering. Over the years, we've had other members of the UWM faculty here who have studied the challenges of getting women into the engineering field to begin with. You are noteworthy in that you not only are a faculty member who represents a gender not well represented in the engineering industry or business, but you also personally have made this a passion of yours to try to get more women to enter into the field.
Sure.
So what motivated you, first of all, to become an engineer in the first place?
So I came from a family of, thankfully, a mom and a dad who are in the STEM field. And so even though my older brother was, I say he is the best marketer, and I cannot rival the way of his marketing ability. And so from a very early age, I knew that languages were not my cup of tea, neither was history or geography or even economics. And so I knew STEM was where I found my passion in math and physics and chemistry and biology.
And you were born in Kenya.
I was born in Kenya.
How old were you when you came to the United States?
I was about 24 years.
So you got your undergraduate education in Kenya.
Exactly.
And so, you've discovered early that that numbers and calculus and physics were more of your liking.
It sort of came a little more easier than the rest of the the topics.
I should tell our listeners, I in doing research here, I was told that back in Kenya that your fellow students, your classmates, called you the professor. Is that true?
Yes. And
when you were very young, still
a
teenager.
I laugh about it, yes. Still a teenager in the early years of high school, and I do not know really why they did it, but I think it's really because we had study groups, and within the study group, there was always a scribe. And I took the notes. And so we would pass around the notes when exams came around.
So you were the most valuable person in those meetings.
we all were, but I was the scribe. So I had to be faithful in following the discussions. And so, but all in all, I got into the university in Kenya. And, you know, what struck me was the fact that there were no women faculty at the time. I should say there was only one who taught me, and she was a very good professor from Russia. And she taught
me. So she wasn't Kenyan?
She was not Kenyan. She was married to actually a Kenyan professor, so I would say she was Kenyan eventually, but she was from Russia. And she taught me engineering drawing at a time when we did not have computers. And so we didn't have computer-aided design. So from her, I had to learn how to be very precise, very thorough, because you will not want to redo a whole drawing after spending all time on it. We pulled all-nighters with my friends. And so from, you know, at the time, I realized that as women, we probably had to struggle a lot more, spend more time studying in order to prove that we belonged. Something that I would have done differently. Maybe I would have put more time in outreach as an engineering undergraduate student, which we had the opportunities, but not quite. And so for that reason, I decided that my passion would also be engineering education and mostly in increasing diversity, which is something that we are struggling with in the world, not just Kenya, not Africa alone, but also here.
I was going to say, although you didn't have any role models to speak of, aside from the one in Kenya, when you came to America and worked on your master's and ultimately your PhD, did you find any more women teaching you? Or was back at that time, was it still difficult to find female role models?
Still difficult, but there were more here, definitely. The U.S. is huge, and it's the diversity here cannot be paralleled. And so I found a lot more faculty, female faculty here than I did before.
So what is it that makes it so difficult for young women to find their place in the engineering field? Is it the lack of diversity in terms of those mentors, those teachers, or is there something else going on that is discouraging women from entering the STEM fields in the number that you think they should?
There are many reasons. And, you know, we live in a world where we talk about targeted learning. There are broadly many reasons, and there are, again, individually many reasons. And so I think we live at a time where we could do research to determine why is it that we are not able to attract a lot more female engineers into UWM, for instance, work with high schools. Probably, I would say, even beyond high school, really work with elementary. Because by the time students reach the middle school, they probably know where they belong, like it did for me. I knew at the age of, I believe I was in sixth grade, I knew definitely that math and science is where I belonged. So, and then the other thing is create an environment that is welcoming for women. Is it different from the environment that's welcoming for men? Probably, because we are created differently, but all together we have to create these environments that are welcoming for all diverse populations.
Are you encouraged? Are you hopeful that that we're moving in the right direction in terms of getting more women in to the STEM field?
Definitely. Very much so, because in all the outreach that I do and my colleagues do, we see that there are girls who are interested in STEM. We know of colleges that have sort of broken the proverbial ceiling of having more than 18% female students. So yes, there is hope. And I think, like we are doing now and working with Rockwell Automation, we believe that companies are doing it by themselves. Universities are also doing it. I think it's time now we joined hands so that we can do it together. And I think the other thing that really works well is resounding, keep revisiting not just have a summer camp here for sixth graders and forget about that cohort of students. We don't know where they went. So I just keep revisiting until we sort of, guide them towards the career
and
their
what
choice.
About, what about the college women that you see in your classes? Mm-hmm. Do they get it? Do they understand that there's a great opportunity here, or do they sense that there's resistance? Are you as a role model enough to keep them encouraged?
You know, I have served as the faculty advisor for the Society for Women in Engineering. And I would say, yes, I am as encouraged as I could be, seeing the vigor at which they're undertaking their academics, seeing their passion, seeing the time that they take out of their studies to reach out. Every year, the Society of Women in Engineering at UWM holds a Girl Scout Fun Day of Science. And the numbers of students that have been coming has been increasing up to a point where this year we had a ceiling, you know. We cannot accept more than 75 students.
So the students themselves are becoming role models for younger students.
Exactly. And, you know, these are sixth graders to eighth graders who are coming in for that, you know, fun day of science. And so I am encouraged. I know we are not, we've not reached that percentage that we should be at in UWM. And so I think there is still much more work to be done.
Well, looking at the great demand that's out there as we see Foxconn on the horizon
yes.
and so many other manufacturing companies in our area that are in demand for good talent, that has to be a powerful incentive or motivator
yes.
To tell a young woman that there is a future and a future with a good income and a good career ahead of them.
Yes. So companies are working so hard to create environments that are suitable for women. So why should we also not contribute in terms of encouraging more to join engineering so that they can get into these companies that are trying to have a better place for them to work?
Well, Wilkie Starr, we wish you continued success, both in your research on remanufacturing, and especially as you look at not only serving as a role model, but as one of the great motivators on our campus to get more women in the STEM field and stay in that STEM field. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Wilkie Starr Otieno, who's an associate professor of industrial and manufacturing engineering at UWM, our guest on this edition of the program. If you'd like to hear more from fascinating people like our guest today and others who have been on, just go to the WUWM.com website and you could listen to past programs that are on the podcast list, or go to WUWM.com/UWM today and you could see a picture of the guest who joined us take a listen to past programs. That's all for this week's program. We'll see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You've been listening to UWM Today with host Tom Lujack, the weekly program where you get to meet the people behind one of America's top research universities, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Playing a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin, UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and world-class research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Learn more at uwm.edu.